Hi, I'm Lawrence Diamond.
And I'm Bob Matthews.
And this is The Process of Production.
Mate, how's your week been?
It's been good, thank you. We've got to start the show by talking about the big news in the music production world, which is this whole Waves subscription debacle.
Yeah, well, this is really interesting because you were like, have you seen the Waves stuff? And I was like, yeah, they've gone to a subscription model. That's crazy. He was like, I knew you were like, have you seen the next bit of news? And I was like, no. So we were starting to talk about it before we came on mic, and we thought we'd just let Bob can fill me in and we can sort of also talk about it a little bit.
Performed a U-turn worthy of the UK Conservative Party. It was such a big backlash. I'm sure some of you out there were as outraged as I was about this. Well, we should set this up first. For those of you who don't know, Waves, as you're probably aware, one of the biggest plug-in companies in the world, somewhat controversial for the way they do their pricing, but they usually sell plugins and they discount them heavily. And we've talked before about the Waves update plan, which is kind of a little bit of a sneaky backdoor subscription plan anyway, but you know, that has its faults. But at least before, you could buy your plugins, you could choose the ones you wanted, you knew how much you were investing, and you had the software. They just went cold to a fully subscription model. I think if you wanted to have access to everything, it was $25 a month. And they were saying basically, oh, if you've bought perpetual licenses, sorry, that's just not really going to fly anymore. Maybe if you have some, you can have 1 or 2 months free. That was what they seemed to say.
Wow.
And
I
was like, great. For, I don't know, some of you people out there might have spent like thousands on
definitely
on
thousands.
Bundles.
Yeah. I mean, I've spent hundreds. And,
yeah,
and,
so
I'm not working in LA mixing premium records every week.
People who've bought Mercury or whatever it is, you know, that can be thousands of dollars. So like, understandably, people were very angry, and Waves, they did the we listened thing.
Love and, it. Gotta love it. Yeah.
And they basically were like, yeah, we're still going to do the subscription thing, but you guys who have perpetual licenses, you can keep those, and we will keep supporting
them. And I mean,
them.
In their defense, the pricing, as we've said before, it's so keenly priced, even with the sort of ongoing license costs. It's a bit like buying a really cheap computer. This is such a bro reference, but like buying a cheap computer game and then complaining about the in-game purchases. Yes, yeah. Annoying if you're a parent of a 14-year-old kid, but if you're an adult, like, just control your purchasing and you've got a really cheap computer game.
Yeah. They get you on the hook. They sell you OVOX for $29.99 or whatever, and then maybe you have to, when it goes to Waves 14, you have to pay that again for the update plan. It is a bit sneaky, but it's at least you have a choice in that matter. It's not like, no, you just need to pay this fee per month for access. And it really annoyed me. So I'm glad that enough people complained and people did.
And they listened. Now, if they're anything like Liz Truss, they will now go away for about 3 days and then make an assault on public office again based on a misunderstanding on our part of what they were trying to do. So I'd rather Waves were running the country than Liz.
They're definitely doing a bit of a PR blitz in the aftermath. They've got loads of content that they clearly kind of created to sort of support this
roll out
thing, but they're just like throwing it out there so people are maybe looking at more wholesome content.
Well, all of you listening can decide whether you forgive them or not. I'm gonna give them the benefit of the doubt, and I am glad to have been brought up to speed on that, because I was a little behind on that. I'm a little behind on everything. One thing I'm not behind on is our guest this week, Alex Cause Hayes, who he talks about his career in this interview, but he wears a lot of different hats. But he mainly came up with Professor Green as part of a whole kind of pirate radio scene in the mid-noughties in East London, like a really fascinating cultural movement that he talks about in depth. And it's a sort of era of music that I've been reading a little bit about recently. I've been reading DJ Target's Grime Kids book,
cool,
which is about him and Wiley coming up a little bit earlier than Professor Green and Alex. It's a fascinating read. So I was reading that and then getting to speak to Alex about like that real life experience of it.
He talks about being in a cultural movement and obviously not realizing it at the time, and how that sort of feels and how that comes about and how it feels.
Listening back to this interview was such a pleasure, because of the nature of who we speak to, we often sort of get different takes on similar things, whereas Alex comes from a totally different world. He has a completely unique take on things, and we just get to hear about a side of the industry that I don't have any experience of.
Yeah, it was my turn to edit the interview this week, and I definitely drew the long straw with this one. It was such an easy edit. I remember thinking at the time, like, wow, I just want to give this whole conversation to the listeners, and I barely had to make any edits because he's such a fluent speaker, and the way his mind like went on to the next topic. I don't think we really had to ask any of our questions. Like, he just did it for us and opened up like really interesting new avenues that we didn't know
it
existed.
Feels more like a conversational podcast than like a technical podcast, having like hammered you with like the deep inside of like the Wave subscription model. We're now kind of going to give you an interview that's just kind of open and free form, and
although on that note, that Alex does really know his technical stuff. The only bit I did edit out was me asking a super geeky question about the difference between various types of digital clock.
That's right.
And he gave me a very cogent and fluent answer on that, which I thought, this is a bit deep for most of us. But still, he really knew his stuff, and he talks about his amazing speakers. Like for the gearheads, there's some stuff in there as well. But yeah, sorry, go on.
No, mate, you've nailed it. I actually love that digital clock stuff. It reminded me of our chat with Andy Hall about color coding vocal takes. And on that, actually kind of looking back at the episodes we've had, this will be hitting your ears on Easter Monday, if you're people who listen on day of release and sort of Easter week. We're going to take a bit of time off around Easter and beyond just to gather some new interviews, work on some stuff that we want to do for the podcast. We've noticed a real uptick in listeners since we came back in January. So thanks to all of you who stayed with us. Thanks to all of you who have come to us in the new year. We love getting your emails, seeing your feedback on the socials, and seeing those numbers of you all listening. So thanks for that. So yeah, we won't be with you in 2 weeks after you hear this, but we will be back very soon after that.
Yeah, we're working hard to get you some new episodes, so hang in there and we'll
Well, no, see before you we go, we're going to a subscription model. So if you've got these points, I'm joking. Alex, you're a much more interesting and erudite speaker than me. Take it away, sir. Alex Hayes is a writer, producer, mixer, and executive producer from East London. Originally making his name as part of the Haunted House Collective, who came up on the pirate radio shows in and around the E5 postcode in the mid-noughties. He became known to the wider world after producing his long-term collaborator and childhood friend, Professor Green's Upper Clapton Dance. He would go on to executive produce the majority of Green's records, including Alive Till I'm Dead, At Your Inconvenience, and Growing Up in Public. He has since turned his unique skill set, which involves bringing together often disparate beats and ideas into one collective artistic whole, with artists as successful and diverse as Emily Sandé, JP Cooper, The Streets, and Murkage Dave. Our interview with him takes in all of this and more. But he starts by letting us know how he works hard to get the vibe right in a room, and how sometimes that involves making space for more than just yourself and the MC.
Yeah, every artist is different. Some artists respond really well to like a lot of energy in the room. Like a lot of the Afrobeats guys I've worked with over the years, they have loads of people come through. Like, it's a bit mad. I remember I was up in there and it was a decent sized room, but you know, it wasn't massive. But they'd come through with like 10, 15 people sometimes. And they're just dotted around, squished on the sofa. There's like four of them on the sofa. There's like some over there and then some out on the balcony, on a little balcony outside.
Yeah, wow.
I needed a booth for that. And
there's just a little bit of bleed. Do you know what? Don't worry.
But you know, and it was really interesting watching how that worked, you know. And when they wrote it, it would bounce around the room. So they would write, they would come up with an idea. Most of the time they'd come and they'd got a song to record or whatever, but they'd bounce an idea and it'd go around the room. Like, what'd you think of this? And then this guy would be like, I don't know, because maybe, you know, you're not putting across this thing. Okay, cool. And then there'd be one person, and I've seen, you know, I've worked with a few of these guys. There was usually one person who wasn't necessarily the artist.
Yeah.
Who'd be the sort of adjudicator.
And
he'd sort of sit on the edge of the chair and he'd be like, yeah, that's good. Cool. Dude, go back in the booth, do the thing. So it's like really like interesting seeing that dynamic, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, sometimes that's the energy, but other rappers I've worked with, they hate that.
Right.
Sure.
And they like being by themselves and they like getting into their own space. You know, Green was a bit like that actually. Bro,
right.
Green, he was a little bit like that. He didn't really love having loads of people around when he was, depending on what he's doing, you know, if you're doing a sort of high energy, like, you know, braggadocious song,
sure,
cool, that's the energy, bring all the people. But a lot of the time you're talking about like really introspective things,
quite professional
really
stuff.
And sensitive. So, you know, when that's the case, it's more a thing of like, I need my space. He trusts me, you know, so he could be in there with me. But that was it. So, you know, just artists are artists, no matter what genre it is, they're all different.
It's one of the things that, like, when we started doing this podcast, like, day one, the first guy we interviewed was quite a, like, traditional record producer, maybe from, like, a more rock or indie background, and had done quite big records in that period. And he was like, yeah, I just don't use a booth anymore. And just every interview we were doing, we were like, oh, wow. And obviously that's quite more common in a like production thing or a MacBook world.
Especially if it's a necessity.
Completely.
But I heard Dr. Dre say that.
Yeah.
Dr. Dre was just like, I don't like having a booth. I like having artists here with me because I can reach out and touch them.
Yeah.
But then I also saw a thing with Shirley Bassey where she was like, it's bad luck having a producer in the room.
Completely, yeah.
So,
and I have this image of like, Shirley Bassey's a perfect example of like a diva walking in and being like, where's my booth? You know, where's my U87? Like, get away from me because I'm gonna do. And like, I grew, my father was a singer, and I grew up with that. I thought of vocalists, like Bob said, going to perform. But like, I think there's maybe I thought it was this generation, but maybe it's been there forever. Of like, no, I want them here. I want that tactile relationship.
Yeah.
If they're over there, it's a bit 1950s Radio 2 kind of sterile, or I don't know.
Maybe, I mean, look, it always depends what's gonna get the best out of this artist.
Yeah.
Some artists walk in the room, they're bouncing off the walls, and you know you've got two or three takes, and then they're done. Other artists come in and they're really timid and they're shy or whatever, and you set up the microphone, put it on loop record and hide in the shadows.
Just let
them do their thing. And then, you know, the first five takes are going to be terrible. And then they start sort of warming in. Mercury's Day's a bit like this. Like they start warming up into the thing that they're trying to do. You know, you can tell they're trying to find the emotion, they're searching for it. They find it, then you've got like maybe five or six takes of gold. And then they get in their head again, and then the gear shifts, and then they try and do it a different way. They search some other way of finding that emotion. And then it comes out in a different way, and you can tell the thoughts shifted in their head. And now they're thinking about something completely different. And then you get another five or six golden takes that are different to the first five or six. And then, so my job then is not to like necessarily give them instruction or whatever. It's let all of this happen. Be confident enough that you don't need to intervene. In this particular scenario. Yeah. And then like when they're sort of done and you sort of, and sometimes you've got to tell them because they'll just keep going for it. Sometimes you've got 150 takes. Verse, I kid you not.
Really? Wow.
You just sort of know when they've sort of, the cup is empty.
Yeah.
Cool, we're going to stop here. And then I like when I'm comping, it's like I'm not gonna listen to every single take. I'm gonna listen to like, well, maybe a phrase of each one. Okay, you started getting it around here because I remember this.
Yes,
between here and here, that's that vibe.
That's the seam of
and then you can comp from the good, I can comp in that vibe if that's the right vibe, or then when you then shifted gear and you went somewhere else, we'll try that five and see what's going on with that, and then I'll knit it together, and then they'll be like, yes or no, or yeah, but I didn't quite catch that thing that I was trying to say. It's really helpful for me, not them trying to tell me when they do or don't like something, but what's the emotion? Because what we're trying to do is empathize. I'm trying to, as a producer, as an engineer, I'm trying to empathize with what you're doing so I can feel it as well. All right, cool. So you describe that situation. That takes giving me that vibe.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick that one. Even if sometimes it's out of tune, out of time, whatever. These are things that we can fix, no problem.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But you capture that there, and I know because I can feel it tugging me here, and that's the feeling I get when I've been in a situation similar to one you just described. Cool, that's the one I'm going to pick.
Yeah.
I have people always ask me, like, oh, how many takes do you record to get a good vocal? And it's like, obviously it depends, but there is always that kind of period where they start to get it, but before they get kind of bored with it, right? But I've never heard anyone talk about coming back again and rethinking it and then having a new vibe, and then you've got a new bunch of takes that you might be able to comp from as well.
And I guess that's a relationship that's taken years to build, so he knows that he can do that and experiment, and I'm not going to get tetchy. Whereas I guess if you're a new artist and you came into a situation with a producer that you don't know that well, that might be quite awkward because, you know, and you might want to just try and catch it really quickly. And yeah. look, if you're at a certain level, everything you do is going to be good.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, but yeah,
it's
yeah.
not about yes. good. It's yeah. about like really capturing the story of whatever it is you're trying to tell. Yeah. What's the emotion? What's that the emotion, arc?
And, which and you can't fix with Melodyne or, yeah. or what whatever.
Yeah,
it is.
No, you can't. You can't yeah. give them that. Yeah, that's the yeah. thing that makes you a human being. You know, we're yeah. talking about tuning. It's nothing to do with that. You know,
yeah.
all that I'm doing when I'm tuning is trying to like, okay, will this help you say that thing better?
Mm.
Cool. So I don't. I really have no issues with like. Going really deep on vocal production and tuning stuff and aligning things and moving things around if that's the right energy for the song. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes you've got to let it be a little bit off, a little bit below the note or above the note, whatever, because that's making me go like, ah, and that's the feeling I want. Yeah. So, you know. But then, like I said, other people, they come in, they're pinging off the walls and put them behind the mic and you've got three takes and where they're like going for it and it's sick. And then after that, it just dips off.
Yeah.
And you're never going to get that back again. Mm. So you have to make sure you just catch it.
Catch that energy while it's there.
And if I start giving you too many notes, then it's not going to happen.
You're in your head and that ain't going to happen.
Yeah. And then there are other kinds of artists where they're really talented, but they have no idea where to take something. And you have to almost wear the artist hat then.
Right.
And be like, okay, try it like this. What about this? What about this? What's the story of this?
Right. Yeah.
And we talk for like an hour, 2 hours before even press go. And they're like, oh, you know, shouldn't we get going? Well, we're making music right now.
We're
having this conversation. Yeah. So, you know, and then I figure out what's going on in their head and what the emotions are. And I'm like, okay, try it a little bit like this. And then they start getting into it. And then, you know, after that, they can be more self-sufficient. But
and you're kind of doing like, you're sort of doing a pre-production job, which like 10 or 20 years ago, an artist would have had 6 months to do that to like, you've been singing this song in bars or with your band. And but actually, maybe they've just written that track a week ago and the label like, boom, this is going to go. Let's get you in with Alex. And you're like, let's spend some time actually thinking about what you're trying to deliver here. And that must be quite an exciting part of the job, like to help connect an artist to the song. And like,
it is. It's and it, you know, when I first got into like the music business, you know, like all of us, I've been making music since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I didn't know what any of the roles were supposed to be.
I
didn't know what the difference was between a writer, a producer, an artist even, or, you know, a programmer or beat person.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I was just, or even musical director for live. I didn't know what the difference was. To me, it was all like, we're trying to do a thing. How can I help doing that? Like making that thing a thing.
Yeah. We want to make music. We want to play it for people. I'll do whatever it takes to do that. Yeah.
So like I just sort of fell into a bit of a niche, I guess, of helping artists finish records, whether that be vocal producing, whether that be adding production to, you know, a pre-made beat, which is a lot of what I do.
Yeah.
You know, or like mixing it and finishing it off or even silly things like, okay, I just worked on a project with an artist recently and they got all these masters back. So I've been working with a mastering engineer trying to get them right. And I'm like, okay, what about transitions and track gaps for this, for this thing?
Yeah.
And they hadn't even thought of that. And I'm like, well, you know, if you're thinking of this as a, you know, a piece of art, start to finish, and all the songs, like where things get placed, is really important.
It's huge. Yeah, it's
huge. And so with Murkish Dave, it was interesting because we were doing this. He came through and we were doing it for his album. It just came out, and he's got a DJ background, right? So he grew up DJing. So he wanted every tune to drop on the one.
Right.
So one song would finish, and the next one, bam. And if you play that, you know, with every streaming service does seamless.
Yeah.
And it will drop in exactly on the one, like you cut it in.
Yeah.
Other people, that's not the vibe. It's more like film where, you know, your cut scenes don't necessarily match the BPM, you know?
Yeah.
You talked about exec producer, that role. That's something that Lawrence and I haven't really come across in the kind of records that we've worked on. Like, what does that role, is that kind of thing that you're talking about part of that role?
Yes, it's traditional production in a world of beat making.
Right.
When I was talking to Bob, I said, it feels like what you're doing is like the most modern job, but it's actually kind of the oldest job in music. This is like what Quincy did on Thriller.
He wasn't
pulling the EQ. He was phoning up Rod Temple-ton. Where's Eddie? We'll do this. I'll talk. So like Sorry, but I just—it's really when you said traditional, I said that's the one that was my into it was like
because I mean it was so I got called that by the A&R for Green's first album,
right?
He was the one that coined that phrase to me,
sure.
And again, like I didn't know, I was just like, that isn't right. That can be better.
Yeah,
that could do with a live piano.
Sure,
that can and I was just adding all these extra things, and then it sort of dawned on me like I'm this, I exist in a world of people that make beats.
Right.
And they're the producers. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
Which is why it doesn't really tally with things like the MPG awards and their categories because, exec producers don't get an award for the MPGs because an exec producer to them is the guy on the phone.
Yes. But
I'm not the guy on the phone. No. Really. Well, there's always a bit of that. Yeah. But I'm more the guy who's producing the record. Mm. But I'm not called that. And I've had to sort of get over that. And the workaround is calling myself the exec producer.
Yeah.
Because actually, maybe 20 years ago, what we call a producer in this day and age might be the programmer or the beat maker.
Yeah, exactly.
And the producer would have actually been the guy, like you're saying, like that needs to be a live piano and we need to get a gospel choir on this.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll track that. I can sort that out.
Yeah.
So we both come from a bit more of like an indie band background. Like what's the process like for example, on one of Pro Green's records where it is more that beat making world, like how difficult is it to pull all those different productions and those different vibes in to make a coherent album?
It depends. It can be incredibly difficult because it depends on the egos that you're managing. It depends on the quality of the stuff that lands on your desk.
Sure. Are you like sifting through demos with Pro Green and being
often like he would pick the ones that he'd like.
Sure.
First, and he'd get ideas for songs. He'd play with them and ask me what I thought and stuff. You know, we did a lot of support touring back in the day. We were running around everywhere. Like we did a lot with the Streets.
Cool.
And we did stuff with like Gym Class Heroes and we're just running around.
Wow, cool.
Staying like 8 people up in a travelodge, sleeping on the floor.
Yep.
In a big van, and we're listening to demos. We're listening to things, and he'd coming up with ideas, and I'd be like, "Well, yeah, that's cool. I like that." But sometimes I didn't see the vision.
Right.
I have to be honest about that. Amazing. Because, like, he played me "I Need You Tonight." The beat. I remember we were on the way to Brighton. We did a show to 12 people.
Nice. Testify, Brighton. Yeah,
right.
So, we've done it.
I've been doing this.
We've all done it, yeah, man. Yeah, pay the cost.
And he played me the "I Need You Tonight" demo, and he was like, "This is sick," and I was like, "Nah."
Right.
I was like, "Nope, don't like this at all." And then it came together, and then obviously that was one of the things that helped him get the deal with Virgin.
Sure.
And then it just blew up. Mm. And at the time, I was still working. I was a music tech in a school.
Right.
Wow. Awesome.
And we were moonlighting doing all this stuff, and then that song blew up. That was I think it was a number 3.
Yeah,
and I quit my job off the back of that. So
you
don't always see the artist's vision. I've been listening to quite a few of these podcasts, and somebody said that actually
amazing.
Somebody said you're not always going to see what they see, so you just got to let them do their thing. But then sometimes they don't see what you see.
Yes.
Which is why you're in the room at all.
And they need to trust you to go like, oh, okay, what's this that you're seeing? And you're like, trust me, this is going to be sick. And it can be.
Yeah.
So when you've got a beat that is cool, that's come from a beat maker, how difficult is it to then, from a technical point of view, how difficult is it to add more or take away from the beat and change it a bit to get it to that final product?
You're not trying to I saw one producer once saying, don't put too much special sauce on my sandwich.
Yeah.
Again,
it
depends, but hypothetically,
it's
just like understanding the essence of what they're doing. So, one of the things that we did more recently, the song was about pirate radio, right? It's called Magic Mission Deja Rinse, which is like pirate radio stations that were all over London at the time.
Yeah.
And the beat was a mess. It was just like this and that. And it had a sample from a classic garage tune
cool
on it. And I'm like, I've been in these clubs.
Mm. Yeah.
I know this sound. Mm. So it's like loads of distortion because all the mixers are always in the always red.
Hammered. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know
yeah,
what
yeah.
I mean? Yeah, and it's like, I've been in these, I know what this feels like. Yeah. So it's like, okay, cool. Well, you know, maybe I need to change the bass line or the drums need to like be over compressed, you know, on purpose because like they're that's smashing off a limiter in the club and that's how it sounds. So it's like understanding the song, and if you really understand the emotion and you sort of lived it in some kind of way, you can find a way to empathize, then you can make the right choices that complement the record. It's not about like, okay, I'm going to make this mine and I'm going to do this my way.
It's
like, no, it's all in service of the song. And I don't actually believe we're in service of the artist. We're in service of the song.
Yeah,
we're in service
yeah.
of the message and the story. Yeah. And sometimes the artist can get in the way of that.
Mm. Yeah,
know?
Okay, yeah.
And that's an important distinction.
Wow, yeah. And you always have to say to them, like what, like you were saying, when you sit and talk to them for 2 hours, like, what is the story here? What are you trying to convey?
Yeah, yeah.
Let yourself get out of the way of that.
Yeah.
And we can deliver
exactly. And like most of the music gets made in the conversations before press and go. You know? And as soon as you press go, you'll find that they'll catch it a lot quicker because they're a lot clearer about what it feels like. But you're not forcing that conversation. I'm genuinely interested in what this is all about, you know? Because I felt this when I heard it. This is how I felt. And what is that feeling? Like, how does that relate to your life? Because this is how it relates to mine.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I didn't think about it like that. You know, this is what it means to me. Oh, that's a completely different thing. You know, and then the conversation sort of rolls from there. Like, and in my opinion, that's music making.
Yeah.
You know, we're distilling the art.
Speaking of pirate radio, that was one of the ways you came into to
it
this
was,
music thing.
Yeah.
You want to tell us about those days? It sounds interesting.
I mean, so when I was in school, I was in a crew called Haunted House Productions.
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, there wasn't anyone playing sort of grime. Grime was new then, but I guess it was garage and
garage,
it sort of morphed into grime. When the sort of MCs didn't want to talk champagne lyrics anymore. And
sure.
I've got a story to tell and it's not necessarily an easy one to hear.
Yeah.
It sort of morphed into that. So we were probably the first people playing like that kind of stuff on commercial radio. But what happened before that was we were on Mystic FM 98.1, which was in a crack house. I kid you not.
Wow.
It was just in a crack house in Rectory Road.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not too far away from here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we'd go up there every Tuesday, I think it was. It was like a council flat, giant block.
Yeah.
And they used to send the kids up to the roof,
with the
antennas to fix them. And it was just barren. And there was a dude called Tall Man who was like he ran the place.
Yeah.
And he would just like guard over it, basically,
right,
cool.
Like stopping anything happening. Like you had your Technic, you had 1210s,
yeah,
and Newmark mixer, and we would like put out these shows. You know, and it might seem weird to people that come from a sort of normal musical background, but to us it was music making because we were playing all these records, and then we'd have a segment where we'd just spit bars.
Yeah,
so all of us were rapping, MCing, and that would go out, and then it was a phone line, and that like, people used to text in when they liked it. They're like, "Yeah, you lot are sick, or you lot are shit."
Yeah, yeah.
It was like early Twitter, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And were you like the DJ would be playing kind of maybe like garage dub plates?
Yeah,
and stuff,
yeah,
and
garage dubs, and you just spit bars over the top, you know. Yeah. And then like we made our own records as well. We used to play our own records on the thing. We get love for them, whatever. And then we sort of made a bit of a name locally.
Doing that.
And then we won a competition to host on Kiss 100 at like drive time. It was like 3 a.m. or something.
Sure.
But like no one was doing that back then. So we were playing all of these records and we did it exactly how we did it on pirate radio. We had a spit segment. Pro Green was part of that crew as well. So it's me. Adam Deacon was part of that crew, the actor.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So we were doing all of these things. And that got us very far, and then obviously off the back of that, me and Green then sort of made it a bit more, took it a bit more hip hop because that was our thing.
Mm-hmm. And were you making? Oh, because I know that you MC as well, but were you gravitating towards like making the beats and understanding how to track it at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really thinking about it like that. For me, it was just like I want to rap. I need to make a beat so I can rap.
Mm-hmm. Cool,
you know. And when I first started doing that, it was on like a 4-track, like tape recorder,
sick,
double speed, you know. 3-1.
Yeah, bouncing the tracks. Yeah, the old Tascam, you know, like for
school, like mono mixes, you know, down the middle. So that and I loved it.
Yeah,
I didn't realize, again, I didn't know that this was a job, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unto its own. I was just doing it because I loved doing it, and I was just making beats. We had Casio keyboards, played a beat for like 5 hours straight or 5 minutes straight. Sorry,
I remember it. Yeah,
like no metronome, no grid, no nothing.
No commander.
No. Yeah, no save.
Yeah.
That's how we used to do stuff. And then I guess it sort of naturally happened that I ended up producing more than like doing the artist thing. And then that sort of got solidified when Green started to blow up.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden I was working with all of these people that are like, oh, you know, we want to work with somebody who makes shoes like that.
Yeah.
And then that's how it sort of started from there. Yeah.
Okay, great.
It's like, I know a bit about the pirate radio scene and like I followed it, but I've never like heard it told firsthand. Like you read it in books and you like...
It was a crazy time. And you know, you don't realize when you're doing something like that you're part of history.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
You're literally part of creating a scene
completely,
and you don't know that you are, and that's when you know it's genuine. You know, we're just doing stuff because it's cool,
yeah,
and because we like doing it, and we're trying to express ourselves, trying to tell our stories, and there's a whole energy around the culture that we're part of. But it's just so natural when you're younger. It's harder when you get a bit older because that gets a bit lost.
Yes. You know? Well, and you don't realize I wasn't involved in anything like that, but you don't realize you're doing it at the time. Because as you say, you're just like, oh, I'm getting to make music this Tuesday. That's I'd do this every day if I could. This is my day.
Yeah.
And then 3 years later, everyone goes, do you realize that that was like the birth of this sound or like you were part of this movement?
Yeah.
I found some Haunted House stuff someone's uploaded on YouTube.
Oh, you did?
And so I grew up, I'm from a very normal, like, as you said, like more traditional, like music background, but from West London.
Yeah.
So when Garage blew up, I was like 15.
Okay.
And Oxide and Neutrino were from down the road.
Oh, yeah.
So that world was like, I was a rock kid, but you had to like Garage or you just couldn't go to school.
Yeah.
So hearing that, and I know that's a slightly later sound, isn't it? Like you guys are doing, it's like the second evolution of it.
Yeah. I mean, and it's evolved and evolved and evolved.
Yeah.
And it's sort of at some point all converged. And now...
That's like, right, yes.
And that really is also to do with the black identity in this country. I mean,
completely.
Of course, it was a multicultural thing, Garage. Yeah. It was. But the black identity of you know, British... people, you know, we didn't know what we were doing back then. A lot, if you were making rap music, you were making American sounding
completely
hip-hop records.
yeah
and if you were making, you know, then you were that, or you did garage and you were over there, or you did jungle and you were over there, or you did bashment or reggae or whatever and you were over there. At some point they all sort of converged, and that's when it got really big, and that's why now it is what it is, because everybody sort of found their identity and it's become a sort of collective one. And it's a great time.
It's amazing. And it was funny because that first wave, this isn't that relevant to the podcast, but it's interesting to speak to someone who actually lived it, like from where I, like that first wave, it was like, this isn't hip hop. Like when So Solid came around, More Fire Crew, it was like, this is British.
It was his own thing.
Yeah. But then like 3 years later, and it wasn't the scene's fault, but it was Britain at large went, well, we don't know what to do with it now because we're not set up to understand Black Britain or like the youth of London.
Exactly.
We're used to like Oasis, and now we're not sure what to do with it.
Yeah.
And it took kind of 8 or 9 years.
Yeah.
And a whole, like you, well, you've just described much better than I could, to then people to come back to like Skepta and all these people, and Dizzy sort of did a bridge, and people like you did a bridge, and Pro Green, and suddenly you're like, oh, now this is, we do know what to do with it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, we had to find that for ourselves. I mean, I've been told to my face by A&Rs that rap music will never be a thing in this country.
Right.
They said that to my face.
It does.
You know, like, take the skills that you have, take that urban essence that you've got and make some pop records.
Right.
It ain't gonna happen for you guys. Now every pop record sounds like a rap record.
Yeah, Kahan, rap is pop is come to rap and
You know, there's no distinction now.
So tell us about like the next steps in your career after maybe like the Pro Green projects blew up, and then you're having conversations with major labels and projects where major labels are involved. Like, what was that period of your career like?
I mean, that was a crazy time. It was so intense because I was, like I said, you know, I was doing all sorts. I wasn't just producing the records or recording or mixing or whatever. I was doing so many things. I was MD in the band.
Yeah.
We were touring all over the world.
Wow.
You know, we're here, we're there. D- did Glastonbury Pyramid Stage. Yeah. You know, like I know what it looks like inside.
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah. You know, it's just a little triangle. It actually feels really small. Yeah. And insignificant.
Looks better from out
there. When you're inside, when you're outside, you see it all. And it's just like with all the flags and everything, it's crazy. But
wow.
So, like, you know, it was just a whirlwind and it's a bit of a blur, if I'm honest.
Yeah, sure.
All of that stuff. And it, what kind of happened over that period of time was we'd known each other since we were 14. 13, 14, you live around the corner from me.
Sure.
Yeah.
And when you're in a that intense relationship like that with somebody over such a long period of time, you know, and especially, you know, you're the artist, I'm the producer, you can enter into an unhealthy dynamic if you're not in tune enough with yourself and your emotions. And I think that's sort of what happened.
Sure.
Over a period of time is like, you know, we were butting heads a lot more in the studio, and then getting that last record done was really, really difficult for both of us. Mm-hmm. You know, there were all sorts of things going on in his personal life and stuff going on with me. Mm. So it sort of like, it sort of spiked at around sort of 2011, Read All About came out, number one hit, you know. Yeah. Big thing. We went and mixed it out in New York in Jungle City, and I met everybody. That, you know, it was one of the most memorable times of my life doing that. It was incredible. But then after that, it got quite tough because, you know, you have to then follow that up.
Sure.
And I think it just created like this weird dynamic. So, you know, we sort of agreed at the end of that, like maybe it's time we went
and did we've climbed
other...
the mountain. And
we'll go do some other things.
That's good that you're able to do that in a sort of conscientious way, understanding each other. Maybe you're giving us a really like,
but like, you know, it is what it is. This is what life's all
about.
You know what I mean? You know, figuring out all of these feelings and how they all tie together. And at some point they converge and enter into a song, you know, you don't have any choice over that. I don't think. You know?
Yeah. And so you kind of had a moment, right. That's that fate, that chapter maybe. And like, no way.
Yeah. So then after that, I started working with an artist called Hannah V, a producer, incredible producer called Hannah V, a very, very close friend of mine. And we started putting together an album for her. She got a deal with Sony and we were working on loads of records and we put out some really cool things. And it was a nice bit of fresh air for me because I could stretch my legs a bit more. You know, she was a producer. So I was writing loads of the hooks. I was writing loads of the songs. Mm-hmm. I was like contributing loads to the production and the beat making and all of these things. And we're doing all this stuff. And we did that for a long time. And I think that was probably the most creative period of my life. It was
awesome.
Just after that, between then and sort of maybe 2015, 2016, it was like I had songs just falling out of me all the time.
Awesome.
And it was really great, you know. And you don't realize at the time, again, you don't really realize that you're in a moment doing something really cool.
Mm. Yeah.
So that was dope. And then I was writing with loads of people. But then how I sort of fell into mixing was a bit weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
So like, you know, at the same time I'm working with Mercus Dave doing all these things.
Yeah.
And I opened a commercial studio at the premises. So I had a room upstairs and I spoke to Maloko and I'm like, I've got this room, you know. It was just sort of a side hustle in my head and it turned into this like really cool thing. And in the sort of 3 years I was running that place, I met so many artists. I got to see so many different ways of working I never would have seen had I have stepped in as myself.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know, people get me in to do a record.
Yeah.
It sort of goes a certain way.
Yeah, you're doing your
dynamic.
Alex thing. That's why they've called you. Right.
But then with that, you know, you're sort of like a lot of the time I was just assisting the sessions. You know, I took the booking and I'd sit in a room and I'd just get to watch all of this great stuff. Coming up the way that I did, you didn't really get to do that because I didn't do the traditional sort of tape op to engineer to producer route. I didn't
completely
go that way at all. And it was just fascinating to me just sitting there as a fly on the wall and seeing all of this sort of creative stuff going on. And it was so inspiring.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I just started tinkering a bit more in engineering. Found I really loved it. And, you know, now I'm just pretty much mixing 80% of the time.
Awesome.
Oh, cool.
It's also a good part of like the life, like narrative. We were talking this morning. I've got two young boys, three and 8 months old. And like,
you can't be going to Brighton to play to 12 people and sleep on the floor with eight of your mates when you've got like, when you're a bit older in life.
Life changes.
Life changes and mixing like is your, you control your life and your world a bit more and it's.
Yeah. And also, you know, I remember I was talking to Wes Clark about this, who's probably the biggest mix engineer in the country. Yeah. One of them. And he was saying, you know, I don't have to stay on top of culture. As much,
yeah.
You know, and I think no, obviously
you do have to know.
You do to a degree. You have to know what's going on, and if you're working at a certain level, you're sort of seeing this naturally.
You see that
anyway.
Culture. You are helping make the culture. Yeah,
yeah, right. But I know what he means in that. Yeah. When I was doing all the pirate radio stuff, I didn't know I was part of making culture.
Yeah. No.
You're just doing it because that's just what feels right at the time. Whereas now I'm nearly 40 years old. And it's like, you know, I'm not in that white hot space anymore like I used to be.
Yeah.
So you know, mixing, I can now see what you're trying to do. I know what the young me is trying to do in these records.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been you and you can't quite get to here, but I can
you're trying to get you think that it's great, but I know that, you know, you've got another 40% to go before it's where it needs to be at. Mm. So and then obviously like I still, the lines are really blurry with what I do. So I'm like, nah, I need to change that bass line.
Yeah.
Playing B-line in, or I'm always changing kicks and snares. I now know you can't hear that because your room's too small. Yeah. Or you can't hear that because of the speakers that you've got. So I know that the reason you've chose that kick drum is because you couldn't hear the bottom end in it.
Yeah.
Yes. And I know the reason you've chosen that snare is because you couldn't hear the ring on it.
Yeah, or whatever.
Yeah. So I'm gonna. This is what you meant.
Yeah, but once this goes on a speaker system, that's gonna be too much.
Yeah, yeah.
So
exactly.
I can choose this for.
So
you.
I'm just gonna change that.
Yeah.
And you know, it's changing sort of bedroom production into records.
Yeah.
Has sort of become my niche now.
Right.
And that's what I do.
Yeah.
Most of the time. Yeah. This is really cool.
What was that learning process for you like with mixing then? Because there's some real technical aspects to it. Like, did it take a while, or did you just kind of jump in and figure it out?
As a producer, you're
mixing every day.
You are doing mixes.
Mm.
I guess it becomes more focused when you start thinking about translation. So Sonarworks reference 4-5 years ago changed my whole life because I'm like, oh, my room has got a 6 dB boost at 40 hertz and a 6 dB cut at 55.
Oh, right.
And then it's got another 6 dB cut at 100 hertz. That's right where your bass drum is. That's right where the bottom of your bass is at.
Mm.
And I literally, I'm not hearing this right. So I'm like trying to EQ it out and like compensate. So you just, I guess the technical part of mixing for me has been around understanding how things translate, why my mixes weren't as good when I was producing. Because you're not thinking like that. As a producer, you're thinking, I need to get this idea out. I need to get the best out of the artist. You can't focus too much on like too many technical things because it slows everything down.
Yeah.
You just got to try and get the best out of people and do it. And you're in a vibe and it's way too loud.
Yeah, always. Yeah.
You know, for you to be able to hear it accurately. Whereas now I listen really quietly all day long. And, you know, I've got a pair of Key 3 speakers, which get rid of the whole front wall in my room.
Great.
And I'm flat to nearly 15 hertz in a small room, which is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the difference it's making to my mixes is night and day. And so I guess technical things like that are important.
Yeah.
Mm. You start paying more attention to what your attack and release is doing on your compression.
Sure.
You pay more attention to, like, harmonics. Okay, if I put that plug in on my mix bus, then that happens to the bottom end. The top end's getting a bit smeared, but I kind of like the vibe. What does that do to me emotionally?
Yeah.
This, cool. So I guess that's been the change in approach. It's been more detail orientated on some of these things that affect translation.
Yeah. Mm. To the vibe that you're used to. I like that what you're saying about, like, I know what you're trying to do to that kind of 25-year-old who's in the bedroom.
Yeah.
But I can now get you the detail to actually achieve
what
you felt when you maybe had five guys in the room and you were cranking it.
Exactly. And I know, you know, you've got a pair of focal twins. Yeah. They distort really nicely. So they're sick for making beats.
Yeah.
You can go really loud and it sounds incredible because it's like distorted and it's this and it's that. Because I've been that guy bouncing around the room like, this is dope. Yeah. And then you play it in a club and like, oh my God.
Stop.
Even in the car, it's like, this is way off. Why? You know, now I know why.
Yeah.
and I can help that younger me, you know, make those choices and make better records off the back of that, you know. And it's always, most of the time, it's bottom end is the biggest problem.
Right.
Sure. No, people can't hear it. It's the hardest thing to get right in a room.
Yeah. 100%. Yes.
So it's like, okay, that bass drum, it's hitting here like this, and then there's like a transient off the back of it, and it's got this big 40 hertz sub that goes, boom. You couldn't hear that at all.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I've got to then like shape the transient so it then ducks that tail at the end. Completely. Then you get the punch, but you still got the sort of vibe of that weight that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And but I can do a better job of it because I can hear what I'm doing.
Yeah.
We started this conversation talking a bit about vocal recording and stuff, and you said like 80% of your work now is mixing, but I'm guessing a big part of the rest is vocal production. Yeah. So talk to us a bit more about what that's like. I guess you're dipping into projects a bit more than when you're exec producing Merkage Day, for example.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. So I do a lot actually still for Reton.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. That record he did with Carlo is such a sick record.
I did a few of those. With that, it's a completely different gig because you're trying to figure out what's the producer going to do and what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And with some of them, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to cut this vocal. I'm going to get the performance out of you and then I give it to them.
Sure.
And they're going to do whatever they do to it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it'll sound entirely different to what you did and it'll add all kinds of effects. Dance records are really interesting for that because it's not like traditional records.
Yeah.
You know, like the vocal is more like an instrument.
Yeah.
Nothing's off the table.
Yeah. So you can just like do everything they told you not to do.
And
big fat reverb everywhere and fat delays and this and that and distortion and
change
stuttering
and
whatever.
Yeah.
But then sometimes I'm the one doing that. And like, you know, I did some stuff with Claire Maguire.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
And that was like really fun. You know, it's like a dance record. Like, so I'm doing the same thing that I would do with anybody. I get the best performance out of them. What I think the emotion of the song is, I'm trying to find it. But I'm like, all right, cool. Let's have fun.
Yeah. Now that's done. Yeah.
Like, yeah, you have an idea. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's try this. Let's try that. And a lot of the time I'll do all of this and add crazy amounts of stuff. And like, you know, when you're running off all of the deliverables, a lot of the time you're like running an acapella. And they'll just slap the acapella over the top of the beat.
Right.
They won't even mix it individually. They'll just take your acapella, stick it over the beat.
Right.
Maybe do some extra processing to it.
Yeah.
Because they're treating it like one instrument.
Yeah.
Often. You know?
And that's with the dance records. But then, you know, if I'm vocal producing, you know, I don't know who else, did some stuff with Ray.
Yeah.
If I'm doing stuff like that, then it's, you know, the same energy I would approach a Green record back in the day where you're like, you know, or, you know, when I'm doing stuff with Emily Sandé, it'd be trying to find the emotion of the record, trying to understand what's going on in their head and have conversations around that.
Yeah.
I did some stuff, not recently, but a while ago with Emily. I remember she was just like, it was like a Afrobeat type record. And she was like, can I do this? You know, she comes from the sort of big pop.
Yeah, world, of course.
Like a singer-songwriter pop world. And right there, I was like, I can see the whole mixed race experience. I can see you're from a small town in Scotland and you've been thrown into this whirlwind of music, the music business world, and you don't know what kind of music you should and shouldn't be making and what you're allowed to make and what you're not making. And I could relate that to my own experience as a mixed race dude where you're like, man, like, how do I, like, who am I supposed to be and how am I supposed to express myself? There's no blueprint for this. Mm. I don't have like a cultural anchor.
Yeah.
And I could see all of that. And so it's just like the conversations that we have around race and we have around identity. You know, it doesn't have to be to do with race, but identity generally with people. We talk for hours sometimes about these things and about how confused we can be about fitting in or not fitting in or whatever. And these are the things that help artists give a good performance because it sort of reassures them that, well, I can do this because this is a part of me, or maybe this is a mistake because, like, actually that doesn't represent who I am.
Yeah.
Even though it's supposed to because, you know, it's Black culture or whatever, but what does that even mean?
Yeah.
You know, what is Black culture? Is it to do with my Blackness, or is it like that's a world that's represented in media, and I'm from a world that's not necessarily.
Yeah. And it's not a one size fits all.
Yeah. Murkus Dave actually said that in an interview recently, and I was like, you hit the nail on the head. Like, we're not represented in media, so we feel like outsiders, but we're not actually outsiders. Mm. Our story just isn't told. So, you know, finding yourself as an artist is really important. And if, you know, you've had an experience in life that can help shape an artist in a way, or help them see things from a different perspective, then you're still producing a record. Yeah. So, you know, like if I'm doing that kind of vocal production, a lot of it's like a therapy session almost. Yeah. And you're just trying to help them understand why they feel confused and conflicted about the choices that they're making.
Yeah.
And help them become clearer on that, you know?
Yeah. And then they're free to perform and not question it.
And that might all happen in a day.
Yeah.
It might not be like, okay, yeah, now go in the booth and there you go, there it is. But it plants a seed, and then over time they'll sort of think about it, you would hope, and become a bit more aware, and it will help them in the long run, you know?
Shakespeare once said that music is the food of love. But what is the food of music? As much as the right microphone or guitar amp, what we eat or drink can be such a crucial part of a recording session. So each week we like to ask our guests, what do they cook or order to get the mood right in the studio?
But I'd be really interested to know, like, when you were doing the pirate radio sessions, how was that like?
Oh man, back then it was best kebab on Stoke Newton High Street.
Yes.
That's what that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like, you know, you're 16, 17, it just falls off you, don't it?
Yeah, yeah, it like really does, yeah.
You can eat really badly and nothing happens, you know?
And at like 2 a.m, you can eat at 2 a.m and wake up and it's gone.
Whatever, it doesn't make a difference, whereas now that doesn't happen anymore. Right. I'll tell you that, young people, I can tell you that.
It changes.
Fast five. What's your favourite plug-in?
What I love, right, when I'm doing a mix, is I'll get it right, and then it's balanced well, and then on my mix bus, I'll then stick the UAD ATR 102 emulation, and all of a sudden it's like, ah, it's a record,
yeah, right?
Because like,
yeah. What is that for our listeners? The AT-102?
It's a tape recorder, and it's just the harmonic distortion at 50 nips. Something about it sounds like Nas, It Was Written.
Right.
Grew up listening to that. Spent every day trying to get my records to sound like that. And now I understand what it was. It was the harmonic distortion in the top that was doing that, you know, giving it that sort of warmth, that bass. It's harmonic distortion blurs the lines. I sort of see it like it's a 4B pencil where digital, people say digital's cold, but it's not. It's just accurate. So you've got straight lines everywhere.
Yeah.
And you get your 4B pencil when you go like that. All of a sudden the picture looks better.
It looks like art suddenly. Yeah,
right. Yeah. And that's what we're doing with distortion plugins. My only plugins I put on my mix bus are harmonic distortion.
Right.
Like, it's just stuff to blur the lines. It's not, I never really EQ heavy on a 2 bus.
Yeah.
So it's
cool.
Stuff to make it big.
That's a good pick.
That's awesome. What's your favorite piece of hardware?
Right, so you asked a few people this too, and I was just like, is hardware limited to outboard? Can it be something else?
It could be something else,
yeah. Key
3 speakers.
Sick, perfect, yeah.
Those things are, like, if you work, like most of us do, in a small room, right?
Mm.
Smallish, whatever, you will never get bass like that from traditional speakers.
Do they use a different type of technology? I'm not aware of this.
What they do is they have 2 bass drivers on the rear, 2 bass drivers on the sides, and they fire bass backwards onto the front wall.
Ah.
And then they it phase reverses, so it cancels it out
from
the sides.
Wow.
So what you get is no front wall. And you know how with a lot of speakers, if you're playing it and you're playing a record that's got a lot of bottom end in it, you walk behind them and you hear...
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
You don't hear anything.
Right.
You walk behind them and it's like nothing's changed.
Wow.
So that's great for neighbor relations.
Sick. Yeah. Which is a consideration.
Yeah, because they're a lot more efficient. You know, I'm in a flat.
Yeah.
And like, I never have any issues.
Yeah.
And also, it just means that you can concentrate all your treatment on the back wall, which is a lot easier to do.
Yeah.
Obviously, they can't compensate for that
because
it's going to slap back off that and come back to you. So if you put all your treatment on the rear and around the sides on the first reflection points that are in front of the speakers, it deals with the entire back wall. And it's changed. I'd go as far as I can now hear holes in so many commercial mixes. I'm like, they couldn't hear that. And I'm like, is that me or is that bass too loud there at that bottom note? No, and I look on my little meter at the side and I can see on the dial that no, yeah, 50 hertz is there and 30 hertz is there.
Oh, wow.
They couldn't hear that, you know.
Right. Wow. Do they come and is there like an installation thing or did you sort of just see, to make sure that phase cancelling works or
no, like literally it's crazy. You plonk them down.
Wow.
And out the box they were incredible.
Wow.
On a remote you got a like correctional EQ.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm hella OCD, so I'm in Room EQ Wizard with my measurement microphone, measuring it, tweaking it a little bit, measuring it. So I spent, you know, days doing that, finding the right position and getting them right. But that's because, you know, it can only do so much.
Yeah, still, of course. Yeah, it's still a room and there's still reflections. Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Like I said, I've got them flat to within 3 dB down to 15 hertz.
That's crazy.
Wow.
And it's just, I mean, they're not cheap, but my God, like to get a room big enough to hear that kind of bass, you'd be paying way, way more. Yeah. So, you know, those are definitely my favorite bit of gear.
Nice one.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Next one's, what's your favorite studio you've ever worked in?
Jungle City, New York. That's an easy one.
Oh, straight away.
Unbelievable room. And it's not just like any space. It's not just about how incredible it is. You know, it's in New York. You see cityscape. I can see the Empire State Building out the window.
Nice.
You know, it's unbelievable. But also it's just the people that are coming through there.
Yeah.
You know, we were there mixing a record. Alicia Keys is just walking past me in the hallway. I was like, excuse me, where's the bathroom? She turned around, it's Alicia Keys. It's over there.
You're like, I'm sorry, I asked Alicia if I'd have known it was
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then we were sat down in the lounge. At one point, me and the A&R that I was there with, and Nas just walks in.
What?
Just walks in the room, and he goes up to the engineers, like, when we going to work, man? We going to work. Sup, fellas? He sits down, kicked it with us for like 10 minutes and then went off, did whatever he was doing. He had a party there one night. There were all these girls everywhere running around, like stuff going on. It was crazy. Oh yeah, Mariah Carey was upstairs. Wow. Usher was upstairs. It's
not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah. Like, no, dude. Like that really was an unbelievable experience, man. Every studio I've ever built since then, I've based around that place.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Cool. Amazing. Slightly more simple. What's your favorite synth?
Well, Omnisphere.
Nice.
Yes. A soft synth.
So yeah. I never grew up with hardware synths.
Sure.
Just because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, didn't have, you know, I my first production computer, my uncle used to run a networking business and he had a spare old thing kicking around, gave me that, had a little Yamaha keyboard. So I've always been in the box. It's just not a thing. It wasn't a thing for me to be out of the box back in the day. But even now that I'm in a better position, I love my soft synths and the Omnisphere is the soft synth as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Nice one. All right. Our final one is, what's your favorite microphone?
So I've got a bit of a story around this.
Okay.
You know, I've
Hit
got
me.
A story for everything.
Yeah.
I've got a Sony C800G.
Oh, wow.
That I bought for $4,500 10 years ago.
Nice.
Just over 10 years ago. And I see now they're going for $20,000.
Yeah.
Which is like crazy.
Yeah.
What an investment.
Yeah.
Well done.
I bought it because I wanted one.
Yeah. Yes. And now it's your pension.
Right. I stuck it up in front of, you know, an artist that I work with once. And he was like, well, it sounds great, but it doesn't sound like a wall of satellite dishes in East London. And that was one of the most educational things an artist has ever said to me, because I'm just like, we can't make our choices based on what's dope. It's got to be what serves the song.
Yeah.
So then I swap it out and it's a U87. My U87 is quite old and it's like a bit crackly. And that was the vibe.
Yeah.
You know, not like a U87 is a cheap mic, but.
Yeah.
But you're like, mate, this costs $20,000 now. Yeah. You're sure you don't want to use it?
It just goes to show you can't think like that.
Yeah.
So, but it is my favorite mic.
Yeah. But if it's up to me, would have been on the.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
Oh, fantastic. And then our final question that we ask everyone is, what's the most important tool at your disposal as a producer?
Empathy.
Nice.
Empathy is the most important tool because, you know, what are we doing this for? What are we, why do people listen to music? What are we making music for? We're expressing ourselves.
Mm.
People don't connect to people that sing perfectly. You know, I know some session singers that are incredible, but they don't resonate with people necessarily in the same way as an artist who's all over the show.
Yeah.
And some of the best artists that I work with, you know, sometimes a little bit off and sometimes, you know, every take is completely different. Understanding their intention, like what are you trying to say here? Like, what emotions are you putting across? What do I feel when I hear it? This is what I feel, and so therefore this is how I'm going to respond. And that to me should be the driver for everything that we do in production. Mm. Like, I need to understand you, and I need to feel what you want me to feel. How can I help you express that better? Maybe by giving you direction, maybe sonically, maybe musically, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's the key for me, is understanding you and feeling what you feel.
Beautiful.
Awesome. Well, mate, I feel like, weirdly with that interview, there's so much to say, but also like, I just can't add anything to that wisdom and that like knowledge that Alex offered. It was just sat down and just absorbed it, really, in the moment, and then listening back.
Yeah, excellent. I feel like that when he was talking about his role as the mixer, that kind of really sums up how he's attained this sort of guru level in his career, and but using all that experience of him as a young kind of DJ producer, and like understanding where young musicians were coming from, and like, you know, I know what you're trying to do because I was that guy.
Yes.
and bringing that energy to his mixing must be really cool and gratifying to be able to kind of see that. And
yeah, I think guru is a great word, because if you've got a mixer who's got that empathy to what you're doing, they're sort of passing knowledge down as they elevate your music up. And I hope that's something that is in Alex's future, more like specifically like nurturing artists. And I'm sure it's something he's doing, but yeah, he sees the path that he's got to get there. And he really understands that. I think that was a really interesting thing he was talking about. And also to flip that on its head, it was just fascinating to hear about his beginning.
How he got there.
How he got there and the route up. Because it is so different to when we speak to guys who maybe are in bands or even pop artists, where we have more of our own personal experience that echoes that. Like, I've read about these pirate radio stations. I sort of know the history a little bit from reading it, but I never lived it. I've certainly never spoken to someone who was at the eye of the storm while it was happening. Yeah. And it sounds like an amazing and exciting time.
You said you found some YouTube videos of that like collective. What kind?
It's not even YouTube videos, mate. It is like hacked audio that someone obviously recorded on a tape machine at the time.
Oh wow!
And they've just uploaded it to YouTube. So it's a lot of freestyles. It's a lot of I don't know the genre well enough, but like dub plates of like jungle or maybe garage dub plates, and they're MCing over it. I used to listen to it a little bit when I was at school. Not their collective, kind of other stuff in West London. People would come in with tapes and pass them around, but I probably didn't quite have a handle on what was happening. Mm. It turns out I wasn't the only one, because that's another fascinating thing about Alex talking about how everyone going to him within the industry, you guys are doing amazing stuff, but like, it's never going to sell. Like, take what you've got and bring it to pop or bring it to other things. And
yeah. And that's largely racism, isn't it? It probably is. I mean, Alex didn't say that, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the way you could tell when he was talking about the A&R telling him to take his urban essence, there was a sort of real bar in his voice that he really took exception to that phrasing and took quite an offensive meaning to it from the A&R.
And
person.
I suppose living well is the best revenge, like
grime and British
hip hop or whatever you want to call it is the dominant artistic and commercial force in British music, and it's amazing to see. On a more like process of production level kind of takeaway, loved that executive producer role that he's fulfilled and how he explained it to us. I touched on it in the interview. It's almost like an old school production role where you're like bringing all the strands of what's going on together and making sure it works in the right way, rather than what has become quite a micro level of production.
Yeah, where any producer kind of has like their hand on the mouse for the entire process from start to finish, as Alex is actually bringing everything together. And and that kind of more global vision being really, really important for the kind of projects that he's
like, I almost feel like the only other comparison is like when we spoke to completely different genre, but like Tim Palmer, who worked on like big U2 records, and someone like a Brian Eno or a Daniel Lanois, who like their background is they can do the faders and whatever, but maybe by the time they get to those records, they're sitting back and going, what do you two need in this moment? What does this record need in this moment? How do you know? A global view. And I really enjoyed hearing his kind of take on how he's fulfilled that, found that role almost, and then grown into it.
on that note, I liked how he was talking about the discussion before a session or before recording or going into a project, and you kind of, you know, pointed out that was kind of pre-production, and I like how much emphasis he placed on that getting to know the artist and talking about their intention, and I guess that comes under the same umbrella of seeing the whole.
He said something really interesting about that, which I love. It's he didn't say it in a hippie way, but it sort of spoke to my hippie soul. Of he's like, those 2.5 hours of talking, that's making music.
Yeah.
He said that at one point. And I thought that was a lovely way of thinking about it. Like that's as much making the music as when you start picking up an instrument or singing into a microphone.
And what should we finish on the just sort of quite comic vision of like 17 dudes in a room?
That's a great
tracking an Afrobeat track, was it?
There's one other bit, again, a sort of a process of production takeaway, but one I just loved of hearing about how sometimes in sessions Alex has got, you know, 18 people in a room and an idea is just being thrown around the room with that energy. And the idea that there might be an arbiter in the room, sort of sage, who's like, guys, that's the line or that's not the line. Again, so different to, I suppose, our experiences maybe in a studio.
I had nothing like that, but I had a session yesterday and the artist manager came at the end of the session and she used to be an artist actually and was a great songwriter, and had some like really useful input. So and maybe that's a sort of perspective thing of like they haven't been in the whole session. I guess it's the same vibe when someone isn't the artist, they can have a little bit of distance from it. And well, look, we should tie it up there.
Yes, because, lovely.
The interview was so long and fulfilling. You know, like you said, there's not much more we can add, but here we are. We have waffled on for 10 minutes.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our waffling. We're going to take a break from waffling for a little bit of time now, get some more interviews and content for you. Do reach out to us on our emails and socials. Email is processofproductionpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, and our Instagram is @processofproduction. Yeah, we always love it when you get in touch. So let us know if you have any thoughts about this episode or anything else music production related. We'd love to interact with you.
Yeah, and anyone you'd like to hear us interview or any thoughts for future guests, do let us know. And we'll see you in a short bit.
See you later. Bye.